Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday. It's 1230. The bear is in the building. It's time for Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. We have two great guests today. Our first guest is Joe Hamm, author of Social Media Matrix, How Social Media Has Confused, Lied, and Made Humans into Zombies, Controlled by Misinformation and Lies. We're going to talk about the power of social media on mental and emotional health, what's an algorithm and why does it matter, and what happens to the human mind when it can no longer discern the facts and fiction. Joe, welcome to PWM.
How are you today? How's everyone doing?
Well, I'm doing great, and I think my audience will be even better after you get to chat with them. All right, so stand by 1 second, and our 1 o'clock guest is Greg Haskin, our old friend Greg. He's the executive director of CoLab. We're going to talk about the ins and outs of the upcoming Slo County budget draft. I know that doesn't sound terribly scintillating, but believe me, it's important. Illusion of creating affordable housing in San Luis Obispo County, and thoughts and commentary on the upcoming primary election. You can call or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Anyway, so tell us a little bit about how you became an author. You know, obviously, I know you have a day job, but, you've written a number of different books, and on different topics. So how did that all happen?
So originally, when I started out, I actually started out writing music. So I was a music artist at first. And then I got to a certain point where I decided I didn't want to do music anymore. So I started coming up with the idea that I should start writing books. So I did a little bit of research on like what it takes to write books, took a couple creative writing classes, and then I started out writing two children's books. One of them is called Fancy Fancy. Another one is called I Love Love Yourself. And then I wrote two horror mystery, murder mystery novels. And after that, I wrote another book called 365 Days of Bettering You. It's called Seeds of Strength. It's basically an affirmation novel. And then from there, I am a leader, and in this book, Social Media Matrix, which you introduced. But writing has always been a passion for me. I've been doing writing since I was a little kid, so I just knew it was something that I wanted to continue doing, even if it wasn't through music. I still wanted to keep writing.
Well, you know, you write with great clarity and great economy too. You don't waste a lot of words. You know, you get to the point, and I really appreciate that. And we're going to get into that here right now. Why did you turn your attention to social media? Was there something there that, you know, piqued your interest to get in, to look into?
For me, social media is more as a point for me to market my brand and to market my books. Without social media, I couldn't get word of mouth to have people buy my books and stuff like that. So I wouldn't say social media has become a diehard thing for me. I kind of love and hate it at the same time, though, because it can be kind of draining as well. But because of social media, that was the reason why I came up with Social Media Matrix. It was just an idea that I came up based on things that I've seen and stuff that I noticed about social media and its algorithms and, you know, the posting of, you know, things online that create an illusion that really isn't true and kind of depleting the idea that reality, between reality and fiction.
Well, you know, your book, and I know I shared this with you, your book closely, tracks with a very prominent book that was published about 2 years ago by Jonathan Haidt about what terrible things have happened to our children, their attention spans and all that. You say it in a lot fewer words, which which I truly appreciate. But again, when I read the book, I knew you were onto something. So I think one of the things that you talk about a lot is how social media grabs us. And it's through the use of algorithms. Explain to people, everybody hears the word algorithm. What is it, and how do they work, and how do they manipulate us?
Well, I think, you know, algorithms are designed to grab the attention of specific people. I don't think there's an exact, you know, stationary, you know, way to do it. I just think algorithms are put out there in mixed forms, though, because, you know, social media has a way of knowing what you gravitate towards based on the posts that you make, so, and the things that you click on. So once you start clicking on, like if you click on politics, it's going to show you all the political stuff, but the problem about algorithm is it doesn't always show you the truth. It'll just show you based on what you are feeling and what your emotions are stating. And I think that in a way, the misinformation can influence you in a very negative way. But algorithms are very tricky, though, and people rely too much on the algorithm and not enough on the factual information. There isn't enough people doing their own research to realize the difference between the illusion and the reality of social media.
So what I got out of the book is that, I mean, you know, and again, I mean, basically the algorithm is tracking our habits as we scroll and click and look at different sites and web pages, and every social media platform has its own secret sauce, right, for their algorithms.
Right.
And ultimately, I mean, it's not really reading our minds so much as tracking our habits and then providing us with content that it thinks we'd like to see. Correct?
Right. It caters towards the things that you look at, though. So you're only getting the information based on how you're clicking on posts and what you're looking at specifically, which I think is very dangerous at the same time, though, because it doesn't allow you to find out the truth about things, though, either. It's pretty much controlling and navigating you through the maze that they want you to be in.
Yeah, like a rat, huh?
Right.
A remote control rat. So, you know, again, and I think one of your major points here, I just opened your book to chapter 10. I dog-eared pages. I hope you're not offended. But, you know, chapter 10 is titled Surveillance Disguised as Convenience. Explain that.
Well, I think, you know, surveillance is disguised as convenience is basically saying that basically what you look at and what they post on there is convenient to the information that you want to have said to you, though. So by making it convenient, it doesn't allow you to go and figure out what's really out there, though. So it's just, to most people, it's just convenient to see it right there in front of you. So when you read it, you're like, okay, I don't have to go look at anything. It's right there in front of me, so that's got to be it.
And really, these algorithms are designed to kind of get us to respond mostly in anger, correct?
Right.
Because they know, or really, they're designed to evince certain emotions out of us, correct?
Right. Because I mean, there could be certain posts, and the thing that's interesting about the viral content is it definitely does shape your opinions on certain things. So, if there's an opinion that you have and you start looking at certain things that, you know, wile you up and make you angry, you're going to start seeing more of those posts. So you start, your emotions get into it. And I think that's where it plays a big part in mental health. Like there's a mental impact in that because we rely so much on that information that it affects the way our brain thinks, though. And so the ability to think on our own suddenly gets shut off because the information that we are receiving is playing into our emotions, though. So it's either something that can make you sad, something that'll make you angry, something that'll even make you even confused at the same time, though. And I think confusion is a probably good way to explain the way that social media causes people to feel.
So you when we were talking earlier this week, or earlier, maybe it was last week, probably. You said that there's four primary areas that this impacts us. So the first impact is understanding fact versus fiction. Okay. How does it do that? How does social media do that to us?
Well, I think that's the problem, is social media doesn't give you information that's like, when you click on something, there's no way to know if it's fact or fiction, though, because you're just seeing it there. And I think the problem is, though, is that a lot of people will see stuff on social media and they'll think that's real. Mm-hmm. But the biggest issue is that there's a lot of AI out there right now that are causing confusion to videos. Like,
right.
Just as an example, with most recent events in this war with Iran right now, is there's a lot of videos I noticed where it shows Iran getting bombed, like, repeatedly. Someone had an AI video showing, like, a nuclear missile that hit, and then when you go and research it, you find out, you're like, this stuff isn't really happening. But mm-hmm. you look at it and you think it's, you just can't differentiate between what's real and what's not anymore. So with this information, it causes you to kind of just dumb it down a little bit.
This really messes with your mind. I mean, your whole social, emotional health is impacted, because it really, I mean, for some people that can't disconnect effectively, right. And we're going to talk about how people can disconnect after the break, but, you know, it really, I mean, it keeps them on edge. It really impacts their mental health and their social relationships, right?
Right. And I think the addiction to social media has a big impact on the emotional health, because we become so dependent, like our dependency on it is so great that everything that we see, and like if we get likes or comments or if we don't, it affects the mental, it has a big mental impact on people though, in general though.
Yep. Well, and I think one of the things, and I don't know if you had a chance to pick up Haidt's book, but I mean, he really does talk about how in kids, this is just creates all kinds of problems as far as their personal self-worth, and mm-hmm. creates a lot of depression and makes them anxious.
Right.
So
right.
it's probably really important for parents to get the kids not to be sitting there, you know, with their phones constantly.
Right. And I think, too, with kids now, like, the biggest issue I have, and I have three kids myself, but social issues is a big thing that's becoming more of an issue with kids now, like the ability to talk to people, to navigate in public, to be around people in social circles, the ability to have intelligent conversation is kind of becoming less, because these kids are so used to socializing through social media that when they get in public, they don't know how to interact. And I think that can cause even more of an anxiety, or like a social anxiety, to a lot of people, because they're so used to, you know, like expressing themselves through emojis, which mm-hmm. instead of expressing it, you know, literally with people, though, they're using emojis to express themselves. It's like, you know, between like a thumbs up or a heart, something like that, you know. So and then I think the other issue is, too, is that becoming so dependent on social media has made it difficult for people to have intelligent conversations with each other, because you know, we get so angry and emotional over social media that I think social media creates a lot of arguments and dysfunction with people, though. And like we can't like sit down and agree to disagree because we're so caught up on emotions based on what we see on social media, though. And that creates a social impact on everybody, not just kids, but grown-ups and, you know, middle-aged people, young people, old people. Like it's just a very bad social distortion.
Well, you know, I know that I try not to do a lot of social media. I really, and after reading your book, I'm trying to do even less. But a couple of the sites, and I'm not going to mention them. But I mean, people just get really angry at each other,
right?
And
right.
there's aren't willing to even think about outside their own narrow view of the world, and then they get aggravated and it just gets amplified. So
right.
You know, you and I we're coming up on a break in about 2 or 3 minutes, so I do want to touch on this subject here.
Okay.
you and I were going back and forth. One of the things I was going to say too is that it's like nobody wants to talk on the phone anymore. They just want to text with each other. Going back, and it's like, sometimes I just get so tired, I just call somebody. It's like, you know, because it's like, what's wrong? I think there's nothing better than hearing a human voice. I skipped a question here in my own mind here. How are you training your kids, not to get too addicted to social media?
Well, we have a big limit though on what they can view online though. I encourage a lot of parents to do that with their kids because, most of the stuff that, you know, like content in general, we have it blocked on a lot of our kids. They can watch YouTube, but usually they're watching like kid stuff. I know my son, he likes watching, like National Geographic stuff. He likes watching, his big thing is that he loves to play chess. So, he watches videos on how to play chess and moves to make and how to win against your opponent. My two daughters, they love watching dance videos, so they're always taking videos of themselves dancing to songs. So, but I do think that like grown-ups who have kids should definitely limit their use on their iPads. I always try to get my kids to go outside and ride their bikes or play basketball. One of the biggest things I think is just as far as having an impact on the way they view social media is to be present in their kids' lives and make sure that they're always interacting with them and socializing them, playing with them, though, because that allows them to it trains them to get away from the, you know, the iPad or the phone and social media though on their own. And then I think once you do that, though, it kind of trains their mind a little bit. So when they get a little older, they know how to kind of break away from social media and not be so dependent on it. So.
Yep. Well, you know what? On that note, I hear the bumper music. I'm going to put you on hold for about 2 minutes. Okay, so stand by. And when we return, we're going to be talking about what social media and not having a clear sense of reality does to the human mind. And then I want to get Joe's tips to everybody on how they can break their addiction to social media. So, folks, stand by. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Joe Hamm, author of a book called Social Media Matrix, How Social Media Has Confused, Lied, and Made Humans into Zombies. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So, Joe, when we were texting back and forth, I was watching a news broadcast, and they were talking about all the AI and it dawned on, and they were talking about the fact that it's going to be hard for people to really understand what they're looking at anymore when they're on social media. And I texted you the question, what happens to the human mind when it doubts all reality after a while? What happens?
Well, I think we just give up. That's my whole thing. There's a movie where I can't remember what the name. I think it was like Wall-E or something like that, where eventually they rely so much on the robots and stuff like that they stop going out. They sit around all the time and they start gaining weight. They become unhealthy and they're just floating around on chairs and everything like that, allowing robots to do their work. But my worry about it is that it'll end up being something like that. You know, we're not going anywhere. We're not doing anything but eating food, you know, depending on how high food prices go by then, though. but I think one thing about AI, too, is it's breaking away the idea that people are able to work. AI takes a lot of jobs from people, though, so that's another spot that we're kind of headed towards would, you know, be a lack of jobs because AI is doing the work for them, though, and big companies are hiring AI to do the work that you know, people can do for themselves.
Well, there's definitely going to be some dislocation of people who, and I feel really badly for the late wave millennials and early wave Gen Zers who spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on college to do XYZ, and now XYZ doesn't exist anymore. And I mean, it's happened before in our history, and hopefully jobs will, you know, I guess more for or turn into other types of jobs. And that's all we can hope for, I guess, because I don't think there's any stopping this AI. I mean, I use it all the time to help build the show out every week because it makes it go faster, really. So,
And I use it for work too, to create professional emails for clients that I'm emailing to as well.
So we got a few minutes left here. What are some of the best ways for people to get clear? To break their addiction to social media?
Well, I think social media. We look to social media because we have dopamine that is created when you look at social media. We're trying to escape the stress and the loneliness, validate the tension, maybe habitual boredom, or I think identifying where you're getting the information from people on social media is a good key. A lot of people like to get automatic responses from posts. I think by removing the automatic response from posts, it kind of limits you from automatically picking up your phone and looking at the post just to see what it is. And then you get caught up into it, though, and you start commenting and stuff like that is another key. I know, the brain doesn't like empty spaces, and I think to kind of replace scrolling with something that still gives you stimulation, like music creation, writing, exercise, reading, maybe designing artwork, calling your friends on the phone or going to hang out with them, taking walks, or creating, business projects or ideas. Create social media windows, like tell yourself you're only going to look online 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the evening, and nothing during meals or works or before sleep. I think also structure can reduce compulsive behavior. Sometimes it affects how you sleep. When you keep your phone nearby, you're always addicted, and really you want to see what's next, and you wake up in the middle of the night scrolling. I think they call it doom scrolling before sleep.
Doom scrolling, God almighty.
Yeah, and then I think also, too, keeping a tab on your emotional triggers to notice, every time you reach your phone, are you stressed? Are you anxious? Are you lonely? Are you avoiding work? Do you feel rejected? Are you bored? I think because based on what you're feeling at that moment can really be dependent on what you're looking and searching at. Sometimes I would say even taking breaks from social media for a certain amount of days, while you're on the break, take a vacation, go with family, hang out with your kids, do things like go to the park or exercise, take a walk.
Call somebody on the phone.
Yeah, call somebody on the phone, talk to them about your life, and I think one of the biggest keys is to not expect perfection. Most people relapse into old habits occasionally. I think spending few hours on the phone, less compulsive checking, more intentional use, and better focus and mood would help you a lot when it comes to social media. And it would also would perfect your mood from day-to-day basis and how you feel in life and the way you respond to people and how you interact and the type of conversations you have. It would make it a little bit more broader.
All great advice. I'm sorry our time is up right now, Joe, but people can get all your books on Amazon. All they have to do is type in Joe Hamm, right? And any new books come? Are you working on anything new?
I am working on another book. I don't have the title yet, though, but I am working on another book.
Okay.
Coming out soon.
Keep me posted. Thank you for taking time with me and my audience today, and we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Folks, we'll be back on the other side of the break with Greg Haskett of Colab talking about county business and important issues that we're faced with.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com.
Protecting what matters on the right choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is Greg Haskin, the executive director of CoLab, the Coalition of Labor, Agriculture, and Business. We're going to talk a little bit about the ins and outs. No, I think we're going to talk more than a little bit about the ins and outs of the upcoming Slo County draft budget, the illusion of creating affordable housing in San Luis Obispo County, and thoughts and commentary on the upcoming primary election. Greg, welcome back to PWM.
Well, thanks, Barry. I appreciate being here.
It's always good to have you. Caller, folks, you can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775-238-KPRL. So Greg, let's kick off. In your latest newsletter, you kicked off with a missive about the candidate BS meter missive.
Yeah.
Did you have anybody specific in mind? Or
well, don't pin me down on that, Barry. That's you notice I didn't name any names.
I noticed that.
We should tell listeners that they can watch these newsletters every week. There's a weekly update at colabslo.org. It's a big problem. There are candidates out there. I'm using the plural. That are taking a lot of credit for things that they did not singularly deliver. And they're acting as if they are the almighty and that they handed down these great blessings to our community, whether it be services or accomplishments or, public, any kind of good to the public. They are not the only ones that delivered this. Sometimes they're building on what their predecessors did. Sometimes they're building on, what the community did. The community went out and organized and brought something forth. And a lot of times they're building on what the staff did. Their staff worked hard to iron out all the wrinkles and make things work. And they're also out there trading on what their colleagues did, whether it's a city council or a board or any kind of activity. It's a collaborative effort, and they're out there, bragging about it and talking about it as if they were the ones that did all the work and brought it forth and put it on a silver platter for the voters.
So if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is, huh?
Absolutely.
Well, you quoted one of my favorite presidents and favorite lines. It's amazing what you can get done if you don't care who gets the credit.
Well, that's a very good quote. One of my favorite guys, Ronald Reagan, used that quote quite often. But follow up with the next quote, which I think is also apropos.
Yeah. Well, and this doesn't happen often enough. A strong leader accepts blame and gives the credit. A weak leader gives blame and accepts the credit.
Right.
Yeah,
and I think that might fit some of the people that are out there, taking a lot of credit.
Yeah.
Isn't exactly it.
Well, that was John Wooden, who, yeah, absolutely. When I was at UCLA, I got to run around Spalding track with him. He'd be out there walking while the rest of us were running, and got to meet him again later in life, too. He was quite a guy.
An exceptional human.
Yes, absolutely. All right. I do want to get to the proposed 2026-27 Slo County budget, but as a backdrop to that, let's discuss what I consider the three big lacks. That's LACKS, or challenges that San Luis Obispo County faces. Every time it comes up that we have to figure out a way to pay for infrastructure or discretionary services and amenities. Right. The first is the lack of private sector economic growth that we seem to have in this county.
You're right on with that. Our local economy is stagnant. We are not growing, and the cost of doing business for our county is growing. So we are really, really struggling to keep pace with increasing costs.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have anything to bolster the economy enough to keep pace. And so we're casting about. We've got the local organization REACH. You had them on a show a couple weeks ago. They are working on some ideas, but even if they had a great idea today, it might be years before we really see any fruits from that labor.
Yeah, and I mean, in essence, I mean, when you wrote again in your latest newsletter about REACH's efforts, that they're trying mightily. On the other hand, I think what really jumped out at me was how uncompetitive the county is to attract new businesses as compared to other counties in the area.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, if you look at the top 10 employers in our county, the top seven are governments. Mm-hmm. And then the other three are hospitals. So, I mean, and hospitals are sort of, I would count them as sort of pseudo-government. So, you know, until we can move on to other top contributors to our economy being folks other than government, which is just spending whatever our economy is able to generate, we're going to be stuck in this stagnation.
Well, and we're going to talk about this in light of possible big cuts from the state and feds on money coming into the county. That's going to be a big problem. I mean, what kind of things do you think REACH ought to be doing, or the Board of Supervisors, or the county, you know, county in general should be doing?
Well, so first of all, right now, every time you talk about economic growth, the next word out of your mouth seems to be housing.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's appropriate. And we've got huge housing challenges. I think we might talk about that a little bit, too.
Yeah.
But beyond housing, we've got to make it attractive for people to make investment, for people to come here, bring industry with them. And I'm not talking about, you know, dirty industry, but tech industries and other forms of employment and industry diversity. You know, we need to have a bigger payroll generating out of San Luis Obispo County that isn't coming from the taxpayer.
Right. What are you, you know, recently, I mean, I also read that as you wrote a couple the last few weeks about this new housing development in San Miguel.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't, you know, you had some issues as far as the process.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, it's kind of what's the word I'm looking for? Typical of what slows things down and makes things more expensive.
So, you know, they came up with a plan, they meaning the builders, developers, to put, I think it was 170 homes in that property that's bordering the river just north of San Miguel. It used to be an airport, and they went through the county planning process. They made all the adjustments they needed. They did their homework. They complied with, you know, volumes and volumes of regulations, and put forth a project that the county approved. They gave them the permits they needed, and somebody appealed. And that appeal was made up of about, a half a dozen or seven or eight challenges to the project. And none of those challenges really amounted to anything. One of the challenges was that it was going to interrupt the fairy shrimp that lived there. Well, there were two different studies done, and there was never a single fairy shrimp discovered. And so that appeal, not only did it cost the developer, you know, a good 6 months and all the effort to address the appeal, which was probably expensive too, but on top of all of that, it's, you know, it cost county taxpayers between $8,000 and $13,000 to address that appeal. And it's one thing if it was a legitimate appeal and it had issues that really, you know, held water that they prevailed with, but it's kind of like a slap suit in a way or something where, you know, you go out there and you could file an appeal for free, and or in this case, it was $2,000 for the appeal. But you can cause all this turmoil, and it never amounts to anything in the end except slowing down the process and discouraging other people from bringing these kind of
Well, just making it more expensive, which makes it more unaffordable for the ultimate buyer, for the ultimate customer.
Yeah.
The third a problem continually that we face is the mismanagement of our water resources by the state.
Yeah.
And now, I guess, Praga has got their fee structure set up. Bring me an update on that. I kind of missed some of that.
Well, Praga, you know, Praga has, they say it's about $1.1 to $1.2 million a year to, quote, keep the lights on. And that's just not doing anything towards making progress to reducing whatever overcharge we have in the basin, but instead just sort of being a present bureaucracy. And that's all we get for $1.2 million. And so they need to come up with that money somehow. The county is not going to pay it, and they don't have ratepayers currently for Praga. Each of the water districts have some ratepayers, but anyhow, they're devising a rate system, and I think they're bringing it forth within the next week or so for a hearing, they will impose a charge, a water charge, in the basin to maintain the lights.
And is no vote on this at this point?
No. The vote was previously on the where they lost the vote, but this is a different approach that they are allowed to do under state law, and it's sad because I think the biggest problem in the Paso Water Basin is the question of trust, and I think that the people that live in the basin that rely on the water from the Paso Water Basin they just don't trust these handful of people that are trying to steer the boat, if you will, in terms of water policy. And until we get that straightened up, there's always going to be tension, there's always going to be aggravation, and I don't see a lot of solutions coming forth about how to recharge the basin.
So this is another $1.2 million to pay consultants and attorneys and administrative people to sit around and have meetings.
Yeah. And the irony is they want to keep the lights on. I don't think they actually have an office.
Mm-hmm.
So there are no light bulbs to turn on or off. It's just paying consultants and all the different people that are sitting there at the trough.
All right. Well, with this as the backdrop, let's now delve into the proposed budget. And I think the first thing I'd like you to break down for us is, you know, let's talk about where does the county get its money and how do those percentages work out?
The county gets its money. A big portion of it comes from the state, and it's considered pass-through money for programs primarily in health and human services.
We got a caller. Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I'm just curious. You were just talking about the development in San Miguel, and that one of the appeals was because of the fairy shrimp. I thought one of the big issues was the amount of water it was going to take, the fact that we're talking so much about overdraft. Was that one of the appeals?
That was probably the most substantive appeal, and it was addressed by the Community Services District that says that it's got the water that the project needs. Part of the water qualification for that project was that they bought a 67 acre vineyard, and they're going to fallow that, and so they get to defer some of that money, and that there were three wells on the project that are going to contribute towards the Community Service District water project, which is being expanded, and they report will be perfectly capable of handling this project. That was the testimony that was given by the CSD, and there was no evidence to show otherwise. So that's part of the reason that the appeal did not prevail.
Okay. I appreciate that. It sounded like it was erroneous appeals, and by only listing that one and not the water issue. But thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. All right, so I'm looking at a pie chart here in your latest newsletter. 40% of the county budget is basically transfer funds. I call them it's not revenue. They call it revenue, but it's really money given to the county
to carry
out state and federal it's a pass through.
Yes,
and so it's not really revenue. They shouldn't call it revenue, but that's my pet peeve.
Well, yeah,
because
it's semantics.
It's theft.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's all taxpayer money.
Yeah, but anyway, so 40% is taxpayer money, and then of course the other big chunk is more taxpayer money. Property taxes, I'm guessing, is mostly
our property taxes make up about 30% of the income. The revenue coming in.
Yeah. So that's 70% of the...
There's some sales tax revenues. There is some TOT, that's transit occupancy tax, which people pay when they rent a hotel or a VRBO. And then there are some other fees that the county charges for services. And so it all comes out to $1.2 billion.
Wow.
Which is, you know, a fairly tight budget for a community of our size, but it's a lot of money for a community that has some economic challenges.
And so, and then on your other pie chart, it shows that 36% of the county budget goes to health and human services. So that includes behavioral health and health programs. That just got broken up and reorganized, right?
It did. Behavioral health, you get more of the mental health services, the substance abuse programs, and so forth. A lot of homeless services under that category. And it all used to come under our health department. Now the health department has very recently been broken up into a health department specifically and a behavioral health department. And so that will give the county, I think, better control of the way the funds are spent and a little better accountability, particularly on the mental health aspect. It's a frustrating category because when you're dealing with behavioral health issues, people that you know are homeless, they have mental health issues, they have drug addictions and that kind of thing, it's really hard to get predictable outcomes, and it's really hard to put it on any kind of a timeline. So we're sympathetic to that, but you know, a couple of months ago we had some reports at the county level about how homeless is down by as much as 30% here in the county. Our costs are keeping going up and up and up. And so, wait a minute, where do we find the spot where we can, you know, raise the flag and say, we won on this one, we can reduce some money because we're reducing the need. And there's nobody that can predict that.
Well, it's the perennial question of when does a government program ever get ended?
Well, that's a good question. But you know, there needs to be some form of measurement of success, some performance measure to say these things are working and these things are not working. Let's focus our priority on the things that are working. And that happens, I think, to a certain extent. We have some great service providers in the county that help with dealing with these programs, you know, actual delivery of them. And so that's very helpful. But, you know, a lot of these programs are mandated, and the state just says, you will do thus and so. And they don't really have a performance measure in them. You just have to go out and provide the service. And that's something that needs to change.
And so as we talked about, so much of this money is just, all of this money is really just transfer payments from the state and federal government. All we've been doing is hearing stories that, you know, I hear the bumper music. So we'll go on the other side of the break. I want to talk about these federal and state cutbacks that are hanging, Damocles sword hanging over the county's head in many regards.
Yeah, and there's something we all need to pay attention to.
All right. We'll be back with Greg Haskin of CoLab. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Greg Haskin, Executive Director of CoLab. Call or text questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So there's reports now because of all of this Medicaid fraud that has been uncovered in California, that the feds are withholding $1.3 billion in Medicaid payments, and also the feds are after Gavin. Yeah. For another 20, I want to say, I think it was $23 billion, I saw this morning, for COVID loans that we're the only state that hasn't repaid our COVID loans.
Yeah. We're a bunch of bums in California.
So I guess my question, and I ask this question all the time, I never get a really good answer because maybe there isn't one. But if 40% of the county budget gets cut, is the county obligated to continue to provide these services? I mean, and if so, there's different types of obligations, political, moral, all that kind of stuff.
There are a number of, and these are mostly state funds, but the state could arguably be broke. We got a caller.
Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your question?
Hey, good afternoon, Barry. Good afternoon, Greg.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
I promise to be gentle. I just had a couple questions. I had a couple questions and some things to bring up, and I'm not going to beat the dead horse, but You know, when on May 5th, when the appeal got denied on the San Miguel project, which went from 50 houses in 2016 to 188 houses currently, with a possible 1 to 3 ADUs on 47% of the project. So now you're over 300 homes on 20 acres, even though the project's 43 acres. But the reason when you claim that, or you didn't claim, when they didn't approve the appeal, they also didn't approve the project. They extended it because Supervisor Gibson knows that the EIR is incorrect and is not up to speed. And the other thing is, it's illegal to transfer groundwater use from one property to another property. So they have no legal standing to transfer water, exchange water, export water, that's groundwater.
When you say they, who is they?
The developers.
The developers.
Any agency.
Yeah. Or
you can't transfer. So, you can't transfer use. The groundwater stays with the property.
So, Greg, you know, I'm not an attorney, and I'm not even trying to defend their position. It may be correct, it may be incorrect. My point, 2 points. Number one, they were able to address the challenges, and you know, it's like any court case, the winner prevails, and the truth may be otherwise, but that's the way that it broke out. And I think part of that, okay. Wait a minute, let me just finish, Greg. I think part of that was because I don't think that the appeal was adequately formed. But the second thing, and this is a bigger deal in my book, is that we keep getting these appeals coming through to the Board of Supervisors, and so many of them don't have much merit to them or any merit, and it costs the county taxpayers between $8,000 and $13,000 to hear an appeal. And it's one thing if the appeal has... is well enough made that it can somehow compete with the points challenged. But the other is, my God, you know, people can file these appeals for free in the coastal zone, and it costs $2,000 otherwise. It costs taxpayers five or six times that.
Let me close
real quick, Greg.
Yeah, I just want to compare it to one other thing. Okay. I've been involved in a lawsuit with these same individuals for 13 years. It cost me a lot of money and the other 800 people over the basin, but they keep coming back. So we beat them at AB 2453. We beat them on every inch down this thing over 13 years on 5 trials, 3 stipulated agreements, yet they don't care how much money I spent. So they're using taxpayers' dollars to try to shove something down somebody's throat. And you can't claim there's a problem in the basin until you need the problem in the basin to go away.
Okay,
so
Greg.
That money thing works on both sides.
Greg, yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. I need to move on, Greg, okay?
Go ahead.
Thank you,
go
man. Thank Take you. Care. Bye-bye. All right. Real quickly, so, and wrap this up, and, you know, so we've got, they're going to go through this budget process, explain the budget process, and then how does the county, or does it plan for potential cutbacks in state and federal money?
Well, so the county has built in they have a reserve and a contingency fund, which is about 5% of the budget overall, and that's going to give them some breathing room. We don't know what to expect if the state is broke or not. The impact from the federal government and the Medicaid stuff is different, because they're one of the things they're doing is they're clamping down Medicaid qualifications, and then they're enforcing them much more. And so it's anticipated there's going to be a segment of our population that will no longer qualify for Medicaid, and they will rely more on county services. But if the state has to cut back these programs, the Board of Supervisors is going to have a huge dilemma. Do they cut the programs locally, or do they figure out some way to fund them otherwise? And that's very difficult because these programs get very personal
and institutionalized.
Closer to home.
So what does the process look like here going forward?
So they introduced today the budget draft, $1.2 billion. And they have a budget hearing set now for June 8th through 10th. And anybody that has anything to talk about the budget can go to these hearings and participate. And then the budget is adopted after 2 weeks after that. And then It goes into effect in September, and that's after the state budget is finalized so that they can make whatever little adjustments they need to at the end, or big adjustments maybe.
Yeah.
So the big thing today when they presented the budget was that our district attorney was a little concerned that he didn't get the funding he needed for some of the critical staff people. And so there's going to be a bit of a bumpy road on that topic for a little while.
Yeah, so there'll be a lot of horse trading.
Yeah. The other thing I brought up today at the hearing was that, you know, the county draws up this budget based on priorities. And I pointed out that in November we're going to have probably a tax measure on the ballot to deal with transportation. And it's very frustrating for a lot of people that the county doesn't put a priority on building or fixing roads. And yet, you know, now we're going to be asked to pay extra. And so I just told them they ought to be thinking about that as they're thinking about their priorities.
Well, it seems to me, and I mean, you know, the priorities are the priorities. I mean, we're going to talk about this, hopefully, where, you know, how the potential changing in the makeup of the Board of Supervisors may
absolutely
change the priorities in the county,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, there's two supervisor races going on, one of them to reelect an incumbent and one of them to fill Bruce Gibson's seat as he's retiring. And so either of those two candidates in the Gibson seat, that's the second district, will probably have a slightly different look at county priorities than I think Gibson has had. And then in the fourth district, Supervisor Paulding, I can never quite tell exactly where he is. He's sort of led the effort to take roads off the priority list, and now he's talking about figuring out ways to spend more money on roads.
Oh. So,
I can't tell you where he is on that. But
could be because there's an election.
Well, there's a his challenger, Adam Verdin, is giving him a very serious race, and so we'll see who comes out on the top there. But I think if Verdin wins, we will see a very different direction in the county.
All right. Since we're talking about politics, and the upcoming election, you had a great piece again in this last week's newsletter called More Oopsies, Shame and Embarrassment at the County Clerk Recorder's Office. What are they doing down there now?
Well, it's just a chain of things. It seems like it's constantly going on. I mean, a lot of people have voiced a lot of frustration about getting public records that they're entitled to get, and they have to fight for them. They don't get them in a timely fashion, and they have to threaten lawsuits and so forth. That's really poor form. Then on top of that, you know, it all started out 4 years ago when our clerk recorder, Elaine Cano, found a box of ballots at the very end of the counting process, found a box of ballots that just happened to turn over the trend that was happening in the count for a county supervisor's race. And it finished out very close. We're also the slowest or amongst the slowest counties in the state to count our votes. So we're waiting around for weeks after Election Day to figure out who won. And, you know, a lot of people are wondering if that's really necessary. Why are we so slow when so many other counties are so fast? And now she neglected to put in the voter guide the endorsements for one of the political parties, the American Independent Party. And so now she has to print postcards for every registered voter in the county and mail those out because of her oversight. And so the question that I'm raising is, well, if she's sort of this sloppy with so many parts of the election, how about the other aspects of her office, which are, you know, extensive and important? She is the county recorder. And is she making oopsies and causing problems on those levels as well? It's something we ought to be thinking about.
Who exercises, other than the people, who exercises oversight on the county clerk recorder's office?
She's elected, so she's, you know, her own oversight.
Really. I guess there's budgetary oversight, right?
Well, there's budgetary oversight to a certain extent, but they, you know, not that much of that budgetary oversight can be connected to her performance. So, I mean, you know, you can't say, we'll give you six staff members if you do well and only five staffers if you don't. It's just not going to work. So the real oversight comes with the voters.
Yeah,
they have that option in just a couple weeks.
This is just an aside. I mean, is that the same for like the district attorney's office and for the sheriff's department? I mean, it seems like the board of supervisors is always in their face about something. Those two guys, but not so much on the county clerk.
Well, the county clerk happens to be very popular with the same people that are in the face of the district attorney and the sheriff.
I see.
So,
okay.
There's a lot of politics.
All right.
There.
Okay. Well, I guess that explains that. Now let's go back to the slow cod tax. What's the status? Is that going to be something we're going to be seeing in the general election?
I think so. We won't know for certain for a couple more weeks. The slow cod board is meeting, I think it's June 2nd. I think that's election day. But and they will decide whether they want to put their measure forth or not. There are folks who are very concerned that the internal polling by SLOCOG shows that it will pass with about, or that it will get about 57-ish%, and that doesn't meet the two-thirds requirement that it needs to pass. And so there are a lot of folks questioning, is it worth putting it on the ballot? It's expensive to put it on the ballot. And is it worth putting it on the ballot if we know it's not going to pass? That's one concern. And the other concern is if we put it on the ballot and it doesn't pass, well, that's it for quite a while. It kind of, once it fails the public test, it's going to be a long time before it can come back.
And then SLOCOG is the county as well as all the cities and municipalities.
Yeah.
So
it's
who and how many
San
votes?
San Luis Obispo Council of Governments.
Yeah. So how does the vote look? I mean, they must vote as a group body, right?
They do. They have a representative from each of the cities, and then the county has a couple of members as well. And the last time this came up to the board a couple of months ago, they had three dissenting votes, and I want to say 8 or 9 supporting votes, and I think that's all they're going to need to put it on the ballot. Whether they get the same kind of vote this time around, maybe they get more dissenting, maybe they get less dissenting, but my guess is we probably see it on the ballot in November.
Okay, and how does our current Board of Supervisors stand on this?
Supervisor Moreno, who's on the board, is very leery of putting it on the ballot because she doesn't think it's going to pass. Supervisor Pichon has been opposed to any new taxes, and so he's opposed to this one. The other three, Don Ortiz Legg, Paulding, and Gibson, are all in favor.
Okay. All right. So, again, as we go into the next break, we got about 4 more minutes left here, and let's take that time to talk about these two very important supervisor races, District 2 and District 4. Uh-huh. And I mean, give us your political analysis. Where you think the races stand, and then what these potential personnel changes could do to our board of supervisors.
Well, let me start by saying CoLab does not endorse candidates. Right. We're a 501c6 organization, so we are for advocacy, but not endorsements. The second district, Jim D'Antona and Michael Aaron Woody, at the onset of that race, I think everybody just figured that D'Antona was a shoe-in. He was sort of the mainstream candidate that looked like he had it all going and was going to sail to victory quite easily. Michael Aaron Woody comes out of the REACT group that opposed the offshore wind energy. They organized well on that issue, and they're very passionate, and they have a lot of support, a lot of grassroots efforts along the coast. And I think between the REACT's momentum and D'Antona having made some missteps in the campaign, it's going to be a lot closer than we originally expected. It's probably still, the edge probably goes to D'Antona, but I think there are a lot of people that see D'Antona as just an extension of Gibson. I think he's working on portraying himself as that almost. I mean, he went to work for Gibson after he got into the race. So that's, but it's also a very, I mean, it's a 2-to-1 Democrat registered district. It's a nonpartisan race, but D'Antona's doing the best he can to establish his Democrat chops and get out Democrat voters. And so that's going to be an interesting race. The fourth district, Jimmy Paulding running for re-election. That district actually has a 2% Republican advantage. Paulding's a Democrat. Paulding's, depending on, you know, who he's talking to at the time, he's either, you know, a hardcore liberal or he's a arch conservative. And I don't know if he, it's his race to lose. But if anybody can beat him, it's going to be Adam Verdin. And Adam is doing an outstanding job out there on, you know, campaigning and getting his message out. And so that, I think, is also going to be very close.
All right. Well, it's certainly something to watch. And when we come back on the other side of the break, Darcia put something in my hand on Sunday about all the voting options, as she wanted me to cover some of this. Good. I want to get yours. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But we do have a question here on the text. Came in a little earlier. Sorry, I didn't see this earlier. It's back to the San Miguel housing question. The question was, who appealed the San Miguel housing project?
It was a local resident, and I don't have a lot of details about who the appellants were. They were represented by an attorney at the board meeting for the appeal. And, you know, like I said earlier, I just don't think the attorney really made a compelling case for the appeal. And didn't really give board members who might have otherwise supported the appeal. He didn't really give them the means they needed to stand up. So,
all right.
But I'm glad that people are interested in that issue. I mean, San Miguel is a community that's sort of floundering. They're sort of left out of almost the rest of the county.
Yeah.
And this is something that's going to be a little shot in the arm for them, possibly. But at least people are paying attention, and that's very important.
Well, goodness knows we need affordable housing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, real quick, you know, we had one of the things that I really appreciate about your newsletter, and folks, and if you're not a member of CoLab, you ought to be, because it's really Greg and his team does a great job of updating everybody. And what's going on at the Board of Supervisors. I mean, you're really a great, and other agencies, yeah. Really. You had this, but one of the things I've always liked, Mike Brown used to do it, and you've continued, is putting in the articles of interest.
Right.
And this is one I just love. It was, and if you have a minute, it's about the high-speed rail shuffle and how, yeah, Bay Area cronies boards, and, you know, Gavin's putting more of his cronies on some boards here keep this thing going.
So high-speed rail, I don't think anybody's going to be surprised to know that that's probably the single biggest fraud in United States history. Just enormous amounts of money with absolutely nothing to show for it. A complete lie to the public about what it was going to do and what it's going to do. So the director of the high-speed rail board resigned, and Newsom put in a couple of his cronies that live in the Bay Area that don't even have any experience or anything to do with that high-speed rail.
You know, and again, we may want to touch a couple of the highlights of this on the other side of the break, sure, because this is how government programs go amiss. I mean, this is the poster child, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So, folks, stand by. We'll be back in about 3 minutes. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Greg Haskin, Executive Director of CoLab. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week's show will feature Jordan Cunningham, former state assemblyman and president of the Slo County Lincoln Club. And on the one-hour segment, we're going to be talking to Heather Moreno,
be an interesting
District
show.
5 supervisor. I'm sure we'll get back to the budget and get her take on it. She's a great one to really talk about that because of her background.
She's a CPA.
Yeah, yeah. So we're looking forward to that. And then I just want you to know that for June 2nd, which is primary day, I'm conjuring up an Election Day special with Eric and Kenny and Darcia. So we should have all kinds of fun and call-ins.
Nice balanced show.
A
there,
nice
Barry.
Balanced show. So, yeah. And we're going to talk about, we're going to have some call-in guests and all that kind of stuff, because what else are we going to talk about other than the election on the election day? So, anyway, what are some of the other comments you have on this? I mean, this bullet train.
Yeah, the high-speed rail deal.
Yeah.
It's a fraud. It's a scam. It's literally theft of billions of dollars of taxpayer money. And the sad thing about it is that, you know, there's this long, 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 extra long shot chance that Steve Hilton might win as governor, right? I would bet anything it probably doesn't happen. I very much wish that it would. But, you know, if he became governor, I would bet the first day, and I think he may even said that the first day he would cancel that whole program. Democrats, of all the 85 or 120 or whatever number of Democrats running for governor, not a single one of them would be willing to cut that program. Yeah. And they will never admit that they've done that it's been done wrong.
Right.
And they will never admit that it's better for taxpayers, better for everyone to cancel that program altogether, put that money towards something that's going to really make a difference in our society.
Well, and again, I mean, if you're not familiar with this story, and I don't know how you can't be if you're a listener here, but I mean, 35 years ago, I guess it was a ballot proposition approved, right, $33 billion for this project. It's now, the authority now wants $231 billion. Right. Not one iota, one inch of track has been laid. And if they ever get to any, it'll go, what, between Bakersfield and Fresno or something like that?
Modesto. And so it was supposed to go from Los Angeles to San Francisco. By law, the law that the voters passed said it was going to go from L.A. to San Francisco in 3 hours. Now it's going from Bakersfield to Modesto. They think that'll probably be about a five-hour ride. And, you know, how many people even need to go from Bakersfield to Modesto? And then on top of that, the fee, the fare to ride that train is going to require a huge subsidy. Every single person that gets on that train to ride from Bakersfield to Modesto is going to be subsidized by the taxpayer an enormous amount of money.
Yeah. And again, this is just more silliness and the reason why so many productive people are leaving the state of California.
Well, that's why so many people are so frustrated by government, because they see, everybody admits that this thing is not working, and yet no one will step up and kill it off.
All right, so I promise to do this for Darcia, and I think it's important because she really works really hard on this election integrity stuff.
We're lucky to have her.
I was at the RP Slow event Sunday with the rededicate, and she put this in my hand, and she's put together a great document on the various different ways you can vote now, and I can see why people get confused because instead of just going to the polls and voting like we used to, or an absentee ballot if you requested it, right. You got too many choices almost. So her number one choice, I believe, I hope I'm not misstating this, is you should go to your polling place.
Yes. Yeah. And vote in person, fill out the ballot there, and file the vote yourself. Don't fill out the ballot that they sent to you in the mail. Don't mail it. Just go in person, fill out the ballot, and cast it. And that's the best way to make sure that your vote is going to be counted.
And then, I guess, your precinct should be printed at the top of your ballot.
Right.
And should people be bringing their, if they got their mail-in ballot, should they be bringing that into the polling place and turning it in for a new ballot?
They can, yes, that's a good idea to do that. But ask for your ballot and vote the ballot that is available to you at your polling place.
Okay, all right, so that's one choice. You can also bring your vote by mail ballot into the Atascadero Library Elections second floor on or before election day.
Right. So if you want to get it done early, that's, you can do that. It's not as good as voting in person, but I think you can rest assured that they'll probably handle it well.
Well, and what I've done the last few elections is I take my ballot into the RP Slow office in Atascadero and put it in the box, and I know there it's getting delivered directly to the county, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But when your ballot has been harvested, it goes through a couple of extra handling stages before it gets counted.
Right.
When you go into the ballot or to the polling place and cast your ballot there, it's handled by fewer people.
So I'm sure Darcia is going to be talking more about this on Friday. So I'll let her unpack this completely. Good. But you know, bottom line is she wants you, and we all want you, to get involved. Help candidates get out the vote by walking and knocking on doors. Assist with phone calls. Call Republican headquarters to offer your assistance and help. or go to www.rpsloc.org. Greg, thanks again for being here today. It's always a pleasure to have your, you know, your commentary and information. So, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, folks. I'll talk to you next week with Jordan Cunningham and Heather Moreno. So stand by.